So you may have noticed that the texts that we have selected from the lectionary over the last month and then will be into this month have all clustered around the theme, the divine is in you. Last week it was, divine love is in you and me. This week, this is our lectionary text. Go ahead and have another listen. But it's an ancient idea we saw last week. The divine is within us. But it's also a challenging idea. It's challenging to build a daily life on something that feels so abstract. The idea that God is in us can feel aspirational. We would want to experience something like that. It can feel inspirational. But in real life, it seems like, we said last week, the territory of poets and saints. They're beautiful words, but in the real world, we need something a little more tangible, something more practical. And that is, notwithstanding the ancients' persistent warning, yeah, that's a trap. Don't fall into it. And so it's not uncommon to say, come on, ancients. Come on, ancient wisdom. This is the only life that I'm going to get. I really need something tangible to build on here. And God in each of us in God, that's not. And it is definitely a less obvious way. It is a harder to see way. But as we've been saying, those who've gone before us on this very long journey are pretty unanimous in what they say to us. They say living from this notion that can be very elusive, but living from this notion of the interior divine, that's about the only foundation that's going to have staying power. It's the only foundation that when we build our lives on it, isn't going to betray us in the end. Now, moving up the pecking order, as we saw last week, that is real. Chemicals in the bloodstream, kind of real, we saw, but not real enough to make a life. The deeper reality is elusive, but the testimony is pretty unanimous. It's kind of the only way. Now, when I outlined this lesson, my plan for today was to examine another trap that we tend to fall for, replacing the interior divine with the quest for acorns. Now, that's another way our brains betray us, because back when we were hunting and gathering, more stuff meant a better chance for survival. So if we had 20 acorns instead of 10 acorns, the odds that we were going to live went up. More stuff meant more survival. So it got wired into our brains by advantaging the offspring that more stuff was better. So now when we get more stuff, we get a dopamine kick in our heads and we do feel better. And consequently, more stuff feels more real than the divine is in you and me. It feels in the same category of real as pecking order. Now that's tangible. Now that's something that I can experience. Real, but not real enough. So we will come back to that, but that isn't what I'm going to talk about today. We'll come back to it because it's in us, in all of us, to some degree or another. And as we say all the time, forewarned is forearmed. Knowing how the traps are set for us keeps us from potentially falling into them. So we will think about, in a few weeks, how many acorns is enough. We'll think about not falling into the acorn trap, but getting our needs met. So we'll go over that. But this week, I had a few text conversations and a few email conversations that made me think that some why thinking would be helpful. Why? Why is it so difficult to build a life on God in each of us and each of us in God? Why is it so hard? Why do pecking orders feel so real and God in each of us feel so ethereal? Why do more acorns feel so real and each of us in God feel so tenuous? So to help us think about why, I want to use a word that psychologists often use. It's the word projection. And when psychologists use that word, they're talking about a thing that we human beings tend to do. When we are not ready to see something about ourselves, Maybe it's too difficult for our ego self to handle, or maybe it would disrupt our interior equilibrium. Maybe it would challenge our sense of worth or our sense of security or stability. When it would be too difficult for our too fragile self to see something, some part of our brains will do us a favor and keep us from seeing it. It would just be too difficult, too damaging, and so our brains edit it out. So you might have noticed this pattern with someone that you know, that they will be getting worked up about somebody else's flaw, which when you hear them articulating what they're worked up about seems a little bit crazy, because the very thing that they're worked up about is a thing that they do all the time. I bet you've seen that. It happens. And it happens because it's a trick that our brains play on us or for us. Now, when you see somebody do it, don't be too smug, because they don't see that they're doing it. So there's a really good chance you might also. But it happens, for example, a spouse who is tempted to cheat might see all kinds of clues that their partner is tempted to cheat. Or somebody is bullying other people, and they can't see the harm that they are doing. That would be too damaging to their identity. And so they see very clearly harm that is being done to them by other people. It's a brain trick. And there's an iteration of that brain trick that makes this whole divine in you a very difficult thing for us to integrate in a very tangible way. And that iteration goes something like this. The world is frightening. When we are honest, the world is really frightening. Calamity could strike at any time. It could strike us, or it could strike someone that we love. It could be a car accident or financial ruin or disease or violence. The existential threat of the insecure reality that we live in can actually feel unbearable. It can feel unbearable when our psyche is too fragile to handle the reality that danger is around every corner. So, to help us maintain an interior equilibrium that will allow us to muster the motivation that we need to get up and do the things that we need to do, to gather the acorns or to kill the buffalo or whatever it is that will keep us going, our brains help us. Our brains help us by not seeing, by playing another one of these projection kinds of tricks. We don't see how insecure our existence really is. And so what our brains do is they gather all of our best thoughts about safety, and they gather all of our best thoughts about security, which, because we were born as helpless little babies, are usually parental figure kinds of thoughts. Because hopefully along the way, some parental figure stepped in when we were frightened and made things okay. Hopefully along the way, some bigger than us person stepped in and kissed our skinned knee and helped us solve our childhood problems. Someone made us feel safe when we felt that the world was dangerous. And so our brains do their best to gather up these super powerful big person thoughts, and then we pin them on our image of God. We project them onto the way that we think about God. And it's a very natural thing for us to do, because it helps us access feelings of safety at a time when we are vulnerable and building a stable and strong personality. And so during those formative years, when we've got these thoughts about God, they help us feel safe enough and secure enough to leave the protection of our actual parental figures and launch out into the world in a way that will make it work for us. So what we do is we pin on God those traits that make us feel safe, and that keeps at bay those feelings that could otherwise overwhelm us. Fears that could otherwise break this fragile, young, developing version of self. And so thank you, brains. Thank you, brains, for giving us this service. and protecting us from what we were not yet ready to grapple with. Thank you, brains, for doing this wonderful thing for us to help us have time to develop the us that we need to be to move through life. Now, when people who think about the spiritual life think about this kind of brain trick that we've got, we use this word. We use the word anthropomorphism. It's not a word you need to know. It's just, but it's got a couple of roots that you might be familiar with. You might, the anthropos root comes from anthropology, the study of man or mankind or humanity, and morph, which is to change or to change into. And so what it's saying is that we tend to change into the shape of a human being something. You can do that when you personalize an automobile, or where you can give motives to the weather or something like that. And we can do it with God, where we shape God in our minds in the shape of a human being. And it's usually a protective human, a bigger than big human, a superhuman human shape. And despite what you might be thinking in the fact that I'm bringing this up, that is not a bad thing that we do that. In the early developmental stages of the journey, it is a critical part of health and well-being. We have to start with something that feels solid, and these brain tools, they help us develop the internal infrastructure that we need to be strong and to be healthy. This benevolent God, this all-powerful God, this actually human-shaped God, is very helpful in the early on stages to help us imagine the divine. Now, nobody, not the four horsemen of the new atheism, not the preacher guy standing up here on Sunday, nobody should undercut the power of this metaphor for God, this person-shaped metaphor for God. Should not disrupt that until it's developmentally time for it to be disrupted. Until it's developmentally time for the next iteration of our thinking about God. So, consequently, when I was talking to my kids when they were growing up, when they were in elementary school, in our conversations, God looked like a human being. Now, I would mention that God is bigger than any thought that we can think, including these words that we're using right now, but that was just to get them ready for the future. And then when my children were teenagers, we would still talk about God in ways that looked like a human being, but I would introduce some of the problems that come up when we limit ourselves to a God that can only be thought of in terms that are human. And I would assure them that when those ways of thinking about God stopped working, there were new ways to imagine God that would bring about more life and more love and more truth and more beauty as we explored those and help us access the divine through even bigger lenses than the God who looked like a human being. And that's what I've emphasized with our teen ministry, and that's what I've emphasized with our children as well. And that's kind of the crux of the why section of this lesson. Because a big part of why the divine in you feels so intangible, a big part of why God in each of us and each of us in God is so hard to make a bedrock reality in our daily lives is because religion doesn't always normalize. Religion doesn't even give us permission to change the ways that we think about God when it's time to make a change. So if you look at our ancient texts, you can see lots of times when God was spoken of in parental terms, in authority figure terms. Lots and lots of our texts will talk about God that way. But other times in our texts, we just can't talk about God that way anymore. And so we have to resort to other ways of thinking, non-human ways of thinking, non-personality ways of thinking about God. And so you will notice as you read the text that God will be referred to as wind or fire or stone or water. When we are at our best, our tradition normalizes changing one image of God for another when it's time to jump. When we are at our best, our tradition will tell us not only when it's time to jump, but where to jump. But the problem is, sometimes we are not at our best. One of the problems that we face is a problem that all systems face, and that in religious systems are no exception, and that is that systems are not very agile. Once a book gets written, or once a creed gets put onto parchment and then gets memorized and then gets spoken in the liturgy on a week after week after week away, once a training class is designed, those things are put on paper and those documents say it one way. And when those documents say it one way, it's very difficult to transition to another way because now we're going up against the resistance of the systems. But fortunately for us, and this part you should write down, fortunately for us, our tradition has a tradition of challenging our tradition. Our tradition has the tradition of challenging our tradition, and this moment in history is one of those challenge tradition times. But unfortunately, as we're having to go through this very difficult transition that we're going through as a religion, as a society right now, many of us haven't been given permission, let alone encouragement, to explore different ways of thinking about God. And so consequently, what happens is the one way that we know about thinking about God, which is usually our Father who art in heaven, when we think about God that way, and then we stop thinking about God any other way, that framework will stop working. And when it stops working, when we're not given permission to move on to the next metaphor that will work very well in a different context, we tend to dig in deeper to that one. And then we dig in deeper to that one, and we dig in deeper to that one until either God stops being a relevant construct in our lives and we walk away, or God becomes pretty words that is reserved for poets and for saints, something that's not accessible to us. And really the only problem was we got locked in place into something that was never supposed to get locked in place. Because here's part of the problem. The divine is in you, or God in each of us in the divine, that doesn't work in the our Father who art in heaven metaphor for God. Consequently, our experience of an ever-deepening reality that is God or an ever-deepening reality that is the divine, that gets stuck in place and begins to languish because we don't look for new experiences because those new experiences don't fit into our old construct. So we lose sight of God as a pulsating reality that is in and of and by and through everything that is, because that doesn't connect with our Father who art in heaven. God in each of us in God, doesn't fit. So we don't know what to do with it. And into that vacuum that's created, we have to find something. And so we put stuff and pecking orders and moving up the ladder. That's one of the things we can put in there. Getting some more acorns so we feel a little more of that dopamine rush so that we feel a little more secure. That's another thing we can put in there. We begin to make the meaning of our lives on things that do not merit that kind of weight. Here's the thing. At some point, a parental God will stop working for you. An authority figure, God, that keeps us safe and will stop working for us. And when that transition happens, it's often painful. But it's a transition kind of like puberty is a transition. Nobody likes getting zits. Nobody likes starting to smell bad. But who among us doesn't want to have gone through puberty? It is an essential, important transition, albeit an uncomfortable transition. So when it's time, if that transition doesn't happen, it becomes harmful to us. It will keep us from being able to build our lives on God is in us, each of us in God. So, when we dismiss, at the end, we say the same thing. Let us remember as we go that we are, each one of us, carriers of the indwelling divine. What in the world are you supposed to do with that if the only God that you've got is a protective Father who art in heaven? How in the world are we to be carriers of that? Because that God was actually designed to be outside of us. That God was actually designed to be in some external place because I over here feel vulnerable and I over here feel weak. I needed God in the early stages of the spiritual journey to be external because I needed a force out there to protect me over here from life's dangers. That's not what I need after spiritual puberty. I need a deeper truth. I need a more appropriate metaphor because that's how I'm going to move from a second-hand spirituality to a first-hand spirituality. Second-hand spirituality is mediated through somebody else. The preacher guy is a good vote, or the book, or the conference, or the doctrine of the denomination, or some other authority figure that's going to say, this is what you do, and this is how you do it. And I grew up in that context, and that was incredibly valuable. And I want that for our children, because it bolsters a sense of strength and stability and security in us. But at some point, we have to move from a secondhand, mediated spirituality into a firsthand, direct encounter spirituality. That's the territory of our traditions, mystics, and contemplatives. They're the ones who have taught us that firsthand encounter is ours to have. They are also the ones who have told us it's really difficult to get there if the only metaphor for God that you have is our Father who art in heaven. You're going to need different metaphors for God because the construct through which you view God is going to be the construct through which you seek and ask and knock. Familiar with those words from Jesus, that ask and you shall receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. But the construct of God that we bring determines what we're going to ask for, what we're going to seek out, what door we're going to knock on. And if we're knocking on just this one door, all of these other doors go unknocked. And our experience gets limited. And our experience of the divine begins to flag and languish. And then just become pretty words that we do on Sunday because it's what we do. And the idea that this is going to energize and awaken and make alive this new vibrant spirituality, that's not really a thing, is it? And it's a thing, and it's a real thing. Now, again, I want to reiterate, that's not to say that when we are approaching God through the metaphor of our Father not in, who art in heaven, that's not a good thing. That was me. That was my childhood. When I was young, my interior world was made safe when my exterior world was anything but safe. I had a God who was my father. And when my father died when I was 2, and when things got wild and crazy in my family of origin, I could project onto my father who was in heaven all the things that I imagined a good father would be and all the things that I imagined a good father would do. Watch over me and protect me from famine or violence, the texts told me, from arrows that fly by day or pestilence that stalks by night was one of my favorite passages. And nobody told me that spiritual puberty was coming. Consequently, I wasn't prepared when my metaphor stopped working. Nothing if not vigorous, I dug more deeply into that metaphor and more deeply still and more deeply still. And the transition was so much more difficult than it needed to have been because nobody told me what was coming and nobody told me how to handle it when it got there. Well, that's why we work so hard in our community to grant one another permission to do the broad thinking we need to do. so that we can make the transition when it's time to make the transition. That's why I wrote the book. And by the way, get the book if you haven't read it. Different ways of the first book, not the sex education book. Although, get that one too. I worked hard on both of them. They're really good. Different ways of thinking about God help us break out of a limited experience of God. And if you've got a limited experience of God, you're going to go back to that thing and back to that thing and again and again and again and again and again. I've told this story before. I learned to play the guitar when I was 16 years old. And the way I learned was somebody gave me a book of 27 chords. And so I learned all those 27 chords. It was so exciting. Wow, this makes music. And I played those 27 chords. And after I had learned those 27 chords, I went back and I did those 27 chords again. And it was a little less exciting this time, but it's all I knew. So 27 chords, I played them again, and then I did them a third time, and then a fourth time, and a fifth time. At a point, I thought, God, this is boring. And I gave up the guitar, and now I have to go chase down Gene to play guitar for us. When all we've got is God in one box, we go after that box and after that box and after that box, and at some point, it's just not working. So as a community, we're working hard to push past our thought habits, to break out of our thought constructs, and to explore God in ways that would help us experience different spiritual experiences, like God as an inner light who would guide in the darkness and in the fear, or God as inner life that animates our truest being. You'll hear us say from time to time, where's the life in this situation? Follow the life. What we're saying is, if God is life and vibrancy, follow that. You'll find God there. Or God as wind, uncontainable but moving us, or God as a song. Because if God's a song as opposed to a father, then you don't ask the question that you would of a father. Why would my father do these bad things or let these bad things happen? That question goes away when our metaphor for God changes. Now, if God is a song, you say, okay, there's a dance going on. In good times and in bad times, do I dance or do I not dance? Fundamentally changes the question, which fundamentally changes the experience once we change the construct with which we view God. And our tradition has always insisted, if you say the words, God is, it doesn't matter what you say next. Doesn't matter how beautiful it is, doesn't matter how profound it is, doesn't matter how theologically sound it is, it's wrong. It's inadequate. It's incomplete because God cannot be contained in any thought that we can think. And so, to jump from metaphor to metaphor to metaphor, that is bedrock solid part of our tradition. It's what our tradition tells us to do. So, A few years ago, I did a lesson on God as dirt, and I chose that just because I thought it would be intriguing to people, but really I was using a metaphor that our mystics introduced to us, and the metaphor was God as the ground of all being. In other words, God is the soil in which we are planted. That's one way to think about God, because if you think about God as soil, you can no more not be in God and God in us than a plant cannot be in soil, because if you remove a plant from the ground of its being, if you remove a plant from the soil, it stops being a plant. It becomes fertilizer or it becomes fuel, it becomes something, but it's no longer a plant. And a plant removed from soil is a not plant. And a person removed from God is a not person. We are in and of inextricably bound to the divine. So, we work with different ways of thinking about God because how we think about God will shape how we experience God. And for many, the experience of God has gotten rote and boring. And it might just be that our metaphor for God has gotten rote and boring. So how we think about, how we imagine God can awaken us to these texts that we're cycling through in the lectionary becoming relevant and meaningful and guideposts to move us into deeper experience, God in each of us and each of us in God. They invite us to expand our imagination about God so that we can expand our experience of God. So this week, I encourage you to do a little thinking about this, a little reflecting. What is your metaphor for God? What is, when you look at the thing under the thing, what do you find when you imagine God? And then we've got this history of, we've got these ancient texts, we've got these experiences that have been shared by so many that we could mine those for some different ways. And maybe you would think about, what would my life be like if my pursuit of God was the pursuit of the wind or the pursuit of the divine song? or the pursuit of being rooted in the soil of the divine? What would it be like if God was gravity, this pull that would move us forward? What would it be like if God was solid stone? How would I pursue the divine? And so I encourage you to ask yourself, what would I look for? And then look. What would I ask for? And then ask. On what door would I knock? And then knock. So Holy Spirit, ever deepening experiences of the divine, ever deepening experiences of that multifaceted, never limited reality that we call the divine spirit, I pray that would be our experience as we are following Jesus. Amen.